This is the hour of doom
and bloom.
That's right, friends and neighbors. Welcome to Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Podcast, a container of contentment in a crazy, cacophonous world. I'm Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, co-founder of the survival medicine website doomandbloom.net, where you'll find over 1,200 articles, podcasts, and videos on medical preparedness.
And I'm Nurse Amy, also known as Amy Alton. I'm an advanced registered nurse practitioner and a certified nurse midwife.
And purveyor of quality medical kits, some one of a kind, at store.doomandbloom.net. Not to mention the hostess with the mostest. She looks sweet and delicate, but she's so tough she flosses with barbed wire.
Ah.
That's how tough she is. On this show, you're going to get the conventional wisdom, but you're also going to get the very unconventional medical wisdom, whatever it takes for your family to get medically prepared for tough times. But before we start, listen to this.
All information and opinions voiced on the Survival Medicine Podcast are for entertainment purposes only and do not represent medical advice for anything other than post-apocalyptic settings. We strongly urge our audience to seek modern and standard medical care whenever and wherever it may be available.
That's right. Don't listen to a thing we say, but what happens in a disaster when the rescue helicopter is not on the horizon? If the you-know-what hits the fan and they can't get to you, someone in the family better be ready to pick up the flag and take over. Are you that person? You might have to be. Hey, before we get started, I just want to mention that we have completed writing the new fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, greatly expanded and revised, so much so that the book itself will be physically larger and contain, and contain many new topics and more in-depth information on old ones.
When we say bigger, we mean bigger.
That's right.
I don't want to say this because then they'll have to hold it like that, but it is significantly bigger and a lot more photographs.
That's right. It's been 5 years since the third edition came out, so it was time to update, and we have almost 300 images in this one, and the book has been sent to formatting finally.
Yay.
So we are hopefully going to have some kind of update in terms of pre-orders and things like that in the very near future. This is all written, by the way, in the same mindset. The average citizen has to, due to some disaster, become the highest medical asset left to their family. The book's goal is to make that person, the family medic, effective in their role.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but I actually do have pre-sales available.
Oh, okay.
On store.doomandbloom.net.
On Amazon yet, though.
No. Okay. Unfortunately, Amazon doesn't allow pre-sales. You have to, when you upload that book, it takes anywhere from, we've had a couple hours to it being put up to 24 hours. And then it's going to be for sale when it's for sale. And hopefully, fingers crossed, 3 to 4 weeks.
All right. Well,
yeah.
We'll see. We're not going to hold you to that.
But no, but you can pre-buy it on my store. So it depends on if you want to wait for Amazon. We have no problem with Amazon. Amazon is our printer, our direct publisher, so feel free to wait for Amazon. They will have free shipping, and you'll be able to write a hopefully nice review, and that always does help us.
We really
appreciate nice reviews.
And our books, of course, if you order from the store, they come signed to you personally.
Yeah.
That's right, from us.
That's what we like to do.
Hey, you know what? It is a cruel, cruel summer, like the 80s song goes, and everywhere from Oregon to Montana to New York City, they can experience big problems this year with blackouts taking out the AC and making homes and businesses into sweat boxes more often than ever before.
Wait a second. Didn't we just experience that last week?
That's right. We did.
Our AC died.
It happens. This is something to worry about. As a matter of fact, in the West, wildfires have burned 3 times the acreage this year as compared to last year at this time. So the family medic better be ready to deal with heat-related illness. This is not something new, by the way. Summer often comes with a vengeance in parts of North America, and heat waves are indeed a common occurrence. Record high temperatures have been recorded in many areas over the past few years, causing so much strain on the power grid that rolling blackouts and brownouts, like I said, in many cities are almost expected events.
Yep.
Places like New York hit 90 degrees, more than that, 100 degrees sometimes Fahrenheit. Temperatures in Phoenix, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada, they reached the 110s. And the air temperature in places like Death Valley, California may reach as high as 125 degrees.
That is insane.
Wow.
Insane.
So that's hot stuff. Even in the places that air temperature isn't quite as high, the heat index can surpass the 90s, 100s, and 110s. For those who don't know, the heat index is a measure of the effects of air temperature combined with high humidity. Above 60% relative humidity, loss of heat by perspiration is impaired, and exposure to full sun increases the reported heat index by as much as 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. All of this increases the chances of heat-related illness, such as heat stroke and heat exhaustion. People who are used to cool temperatures, by the way, seem to be more prone to these problems than those who are used to hot climates, like down here in South Florida.
I'm still not sure that if it was 125 degrees, that I would be able to tolerate that any more than someone who lives in, say, Chicago. I'm not sure that I've developed a heat tolerance, what have we lived down here? Since 1970-ish.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Since the
we should be Stone Ages. Used to it, but yes. I can't say that I'm terribly used to this heat.
That's true. Well, actually, people die from heat stroke in places like India. It can certainly happen.
Go figure.
Hyperthermia can be a killer anywhere that exposure to heat is unavoidable. I mean, it's bad enough in the country, but things are even worse in the city, where buildings and roads replace open land and vegetation. Concrete and asphalt surfaces in the sun become much hotter than air temperature, resulting in what they call a heat island effect in the larger populated areas. Rural areas are usually considered to be moister and cooler, which I'm going to go off on a tangent here because this comes to something that happened right here in our neighborhood. And that bothers me and it bewilders me.
It bothers me.
Also, right? Well, recently the powers that be around here decided to replace our light gray concrete street paving with black asphalt.
Oh my gosh.
In South Florida, it gets so hot that anything black that absorbs heat, well, you can fry an egg on. What were they thinking? So we looked up the differences between concrete and asphalt, explained by no other than Bob Villa, the home improvement guy. He says that climate is a major consideration when choosing between asphalt and concrete. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. If you live in an area with very hot summers, you might find an asphalt driveway, let's say, becomes gooey or sticky right when the temperature soars.
Exactly.
That's right. The cycle of softening at high heat and rehardening once things cool down can cause asphalt to crack or sag. So again, I ask, why would they put asphalt in on our street? In cold weather, concrete can indeed be a problem as it can buckle, heave, or crack in the really, really coldest part of the winter. Plus, salt used to melt ice can pit, stain, or blotch concrete, leaving ugly marks. And it takes snow and ice longer to melt on concrete than asphalt. So asphalt, great in cool temperatures. However, not so great where we are here down in South Florida. Maybe it's because asphalt is easier to repair than concrete. The problem is that it needs it more frequently. Both asphalt and concrete crack, but asphalt tends to deteriorate faster due to its softer consistency. So as I kept reading about this, more and more reasons to use concrete down here in South Florida presented themselves until I finally got down to what the root of the matter was.
Yes.
Although Villa is talking about driveways here, it turns out that concrete costs about 45 to 50% more than asphalt. So the cheapskates and power down here are the cause, thanks a hell of a lot, and it's going to be like hell here on our street once that asphalt starts heating up.
But wait, the great thing is there's a huge development here, and they just did this to our little section, and it doesn't look like they're doing it anywhere else. I think the people who were here complained so much about it, and the other people saw this is happening, that it's not going to happen to any other streets.
Oh, my gosh.
Just our street.
So we were the guinea pigs.
We're the guinea pigs, and I believe that we're the only ones that are going to get this. And now we're stuck with it.
Wow.
Thanks.
Well, the soles of my feet are going to be stuck on the asphalt if I try to walk across the street. However, I could.
What about the ducks?
The poor
ducks.
We have ducks that walk across our street, too.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Well, you know, at least we can fry our breakfast eggs on them.
That's true.
All right, back to heat waves and heat-related illness. Actually, this is a medical show, so we're going to talk about medical stuff. Yeah. You might not consider a heat wave to be a natural disaster, but boy, it is really a natural disaster. It can cause mass casualties, as it did in Europe, where tens of thousands of people died of exposure. Now, when did this happen? During the plague years in the Middle Ages? No, in the year 2003. You know what? We've been there, and air conditioning, climate control, these are not things that are just a given there like they are here.
Right.
India, Pakistan, other underdeveloped tropical countries, they experience thousands of heat-related deaths yearly. And even here, nursing homes with AC problems, well, sometimes you'll get mass casualties from that. In the United States, heat wave disasters receive a similar warning system as other natural disasters like hurricanes. There's an excessive heat watch. That means that conditions are favorable for an excessive heat event in the next 24 to 72 hours. An excessive heat advisory, where heat index values at least are forecasted to reach 100 to 105 degrees Fahrenheit for the next 1 or 2 days. And then the heat warning, the excessive heat warning. Heat index values are expected to meet or exceed 105 to 110 degrees Fahrenheit for at least 2 days. It should be noted that different regions of the country may have their own temperature range. Even with an intact power grid, large numbers of people staying inside to avoid the heat increase the chances of spreading infectious disease. This was thought to be the case in the warmer months during last year's major COVID-19 epidemic or pandemic, and we're still going through it now, and now we don't know as this summer goes on whether we're going to see the same thing and we'll see more increase in cases. Now, how exactly does heat kill a person? Your body core regulates its temperature for optimal organ function. When body core temperature rises excessively, we call that hyperthermia, inflammation occurs. And when that happens, cells die and toxins leak from these dead cells. Fatalities can occur very quickly without rapid intervention. Even with modern technology, hyperthermia carries about a 10% death rate, mostly though in the elderly and infirm. Those people who are physically fit, however, are not immune. If you haven't heard of hyperthermia, you might know them more commonly by the terms heat exhaustion and heat stroke. There's also heat cramps. Heat cramps are painful muscle spasms seen in those people that are exerting themselves in hot weather. They mostly involve the back, arms, and legs. Discomfort in the affected areas usually associated with heavy perspiration. Simply having muscle cramps or even a fainting spell due to the heat does not necessarily signify that a major life-threatening heat-related complication is imminent. You'll see heat cramps often in kids who've been running around on a hot day. Just getting them out of the sun, massaging the affected muscles, and providing hydration will usually resolve the problem. A failure to do these things, however, can lead to more serious issues. To make the diagnosis of heat exhaustion, a significant rise in the body core temperature is required. As many heat-related symptoms mimic other conditions, a thermometer, indeed, should be a component of your medical supplies.
Yes.
You have more than one, probably.
Absolutely.
So heat exhaustion is characterized by these symptoms: confusion, rapid pulse, flushing, profuse sweating, sometimes a headache is very common. Of course, the body temperature elevation could go up to 105 degrees Fahrenheit, and sometimes you'll see people have nausea and vomiting. Now, if no action is taken to cool the victim, heat stroke may ensue. In addition to all the possible signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion, heat stroke manifests as a loss of consciousness, seizures, vomiting, and even bleeding into places like the urine. You may note that breathing becomes rapid and shallow. If it's not dealt with quickly, shock and organ malfunction can result, leading to a fatal outcome. Some signs of the severity of heat stroke may be noted by the appearance of the skin. The skin is likely to be hot to the touch, but unlike heat exhaustion, active sweating might be absent. There might be some left from when that person was in heat exhaustion before they went into heat stroke, but they won't be sweating anymore. And the reason why is the body makes efforts to cool itself down until it hits a temperature of about 105, 106 degrees. At that time, thermoregulation breaks down and the body's ability to use sweating as a natural temperature regulator fails. In heat stroke, the body core can rise to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. You'll notice that the skin becomes bright red, lobster red, not because it's burned, but because the blood vessels are dilating in a desperate effort to dissipate some of that heat. Now, in some cases, the patient's skin may actually seem cool. It's important to realize that it's the body core temperature that is elevated. A person in shock may mislead you by feeling cold and clammy to the touch. That's why thermometers are important items for the medic to have in their supplies. The family medic can do a lot to prevent heat stroke and its consequences. As a matter of fact, it's their responsibility to. In heat waves, certain strategies can save lives. One, be sure to avoid leaving children or pets in enclosed vehicles. Wow, I've seen that before. I remember coming upon one child that was in a car in summer, windows closed with just a little crack open, actually. And we had to go right into the store. Luckily, it was right in front of a of a store and find the mother who actually came out and was freaked out and realized that her sweating, probably in heat exhaustion kid could have actually died from the condition. So very important, avoid leaving kids or pets in enclosed vehicles during the summer. Two, you want to stay hydrated, but avoid caffeinated.
Yes, no coffee.
Right, caffeinated beverages and alcoholic drinks. This must be my dentures that are.
You don't have dentures.
Dentures are causing
stay
me.
Stay hydrated and avoid coffee and alcohol.
And drink lots of water, maybe with some electrolytes, something like Gatorade would be a good thing. Your meals should be frequent but small. You don't want to be too overloaded there.
There you go.
You want to wear loose fitting and light colored clothing. You want to avoid
heavy perfect shirt
factors.
There.
Yeah, this is great.
Is
actually has a couple of vents that allow you
back.
A good fishing shirt.
Perfect.
Stay indoors and avoid exertion during the hottest parts of the day. Never schedule work sessions in excessive heat. If there's no choice, then you got to have your people rest frequently in the shade. That's important.
Yes.
And give them fluids regularly. And, I mean, almost continuously while they're working.
Right. And what I was going to say is that's why we don't do a lot of planting of garden stuff in the middle of the day in the summer.
That's right. Summer down here in South Florida is our agricultural winter. We do all of our planting and a lot of our gardening and food production is in the winter.
But I do have sweet potatoes growing right now.
And they look great. They're like going to be like this big.
And the good thing is I put pine straw down when I planted them so I don't have to go weed. But if I had to go weeding, it would be early in the morning or late in the evening when the sun was starting to set.
That's right.
And it wasn't quite so hot. So do those activities first thing in the morning or just before sundown.
And I want you to be a very good neighbor, good parent, good neighbor. Check frequently on those who are very young, the elderly, yep, and infirm. They are going to be most prone to heat-related illness. And for goodness sake, don't forget your pets.
Yeah, they sweat too.
They sure do. Another summer issue related to heat is burns caused by exposure to the sun. In most cases, these are going to be first-degree burns. In first-degree burns, the patient may be red as a lobster, but only the superficial layer of the skin, the epidermis, is actually injured. A first-degree burn appears red, warm, and dry. Dry. It's going to be painful to the touch, especially where large areas of skin are involved, such as in the case of a major sunburn. Major complications are rare, however. Treatment is simply focused on relieving the discomfort. So if you have a sunburn, immersion in a cool bath will be helpful. At the very least, run a little cool water over an injury if it's a local injury. A cool, moist cloth on the burn for 20 minutes will give some relief, especially if it's applied immediately. So will anti-inflammatory medicines, such as ibuprofen. Aloe vera, zinc oxide, benzocaine sprays are effective alternatives.
Yeah.
Although hydrocortisone cream is really of little help in burns, oral steroids have sometimes been used for that person who got that full body sunburn and spent too much time in the tanning booth. These are things that you might see.
Also, they did a study on vitamin D.
Uh-huh.
That if you are exposed to the sun and you get vitamin D into your body within a short period of time, a couple of hours, it actually decreases your skin reaction to the sunburn that you just had.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Yes, and I'm going to look up exactly how much you need to take.
All right, that's...
But you keep talking. And
that's
when
pretty
I
cool
find
information.
It, I will tell you, yes.
I know that with the sun that you actually absorb UV light into your skin and helps make vitamin D. Now, adding vitamin D, interesting to know that it might actually help with that. Now, expect the discomfort of a regular sunburn to improve after about 24 hours. Until then, the only thing you have to do is avoid constrictive, tight clothing and wear light fabrics such as cotton. Prevention, of course, worth a pound of cure. To avoid this type of sunburn, don't sunbathe. A tan is not a healthy thing anymore, guys. Avoid the peak sun hours for the time of year and the latitude. Wear long pants and sleeves, hats and sunglasses, although, like I said, loose fitting and light. And spend time in the shade whenever you possibly can. Now, if extended exposure to sunlight is unavoidable, be certain to use a sunblock. You want to apply this 15 minutes before going outside and reapply frequently during the day. Even water-resistant sunscreen should be reapplied every 1 to 2 hours. If you go to the beach and you go into the water, every time you go into the water, you're washing off the sunscreen that's being rinsed off. So you need to reapply it. Most people fail to put enough of this stuff on, so always be sure to use plenty. Now, as an aside, sunblock and sunscreen are not the same thing. Sunblocks contain tiny particles that block and reflect UV light. A sunscreen contains substances that absorb UV light, thus preventing it from penetrating the skin below. Many commercial products actually contain both of these things. Sunblocks and sunscreen should always be an integral part of your medical storage to prevent burns.
I have the study.
Ah, okay. Go ahead.
It was a Case Western study.
This is about vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. And in the study, 20 participants were randomized to receive a placebo or 50,000, 100,000, or 200,000 IU international
mega
units
doses
of vitamin D 1 hour after a UV lamp sunburn on their inner arm. Researchers followed up at 24, 48, and 72 hours and 1 week after and collected skin biopsies for further testing.
Yeah.
Participants who consumed the highest doses of vitamin D had the longest lasting benefits, including less skin inflammation 48 hours after the burn.
Well, how about that?
So, although I am not telling you to take 200,000 international units of vitamin D, a study by Case Western in the Science Daily, which you can find on sciencedaily.com, the title was, Vitamin D May Improve Sunburn According to a New Clinical Trial. That is the name of it. Maybe you can try some extra vitamin D if you accidentally get a sunburn because you didn't reapply your sunscreen properly.
Now, speaking of sunscreen, you may...
See how they rolled that back into
good.
Sunscreen?
I know, and now I'm segueing...
Yes, sunscreen.
From sunscreen into SPF.
Okay.
Now, if you have bought sunscreen, you probably saw something that says the SPF and then a number afterwards. SPF stands for Sun Protection Factor, and that rating system was developed all the way back in 1962 to measure the capacity of a product to prevent UV radiation damage. It measures the length of exposure to the sun before you burn. SPF of at least 15 is recommended. It takes about 20 minutes without sunscreen for your skin to start turning red.
Now, not for me, though.
For you.
Is it about 2 minutes?
less time for people like her who are so fair-skinned. A product that's SPF 15 should, in theory, delay burning by a factor of 15 or about 5 hours before she starts burning. That is, if you're applying enough of it on, you apply it before you go out and, indeed, don't go into the water, for example, if you go to the beach.
And I think that's a good point. Like you said before, you can't just put it on because as soon as you go in the heat, what happens? You immediately start sweating and our pores are trying to rid ourselves of what's inside of our body to cool us off. And here we have this sunscreen that's blocking all of our pores. And so it's trying to flush that out. So your body's actually trying to get rid of your sunscreen while it's on. So definitely do that reapplication.
That's right.
And it's a super important point.
So at least, right, exactly. So at least SPF 15. And by the way, higher SPF ratings give even more protection, are especially beneficial to people like Amy with such fair skin. Now, besides the sun, first degree injuries will most likely be related to cooking or campfires. You want to use hand protection to prevent many of these burns, as will careful supervision of children near campfires and food protection areas. Remember that kids are always curious. They are fascinated by fires, so just be aware. Second-degree burns are deeper injuries that penetrate through the superficial epidermis and partially through the deeper layer of the skin called the dermis. They're also called partial thickness burns. Now, while first-degree burns may cover a large percentage of surface area from being out in the sun without being life-threatening, a relatively small percentage of the area covered with significant second-degree burns may require serious medical intervention, another great reason to prevent them. Unlike first-degree burns, which appear dry, second-degree burns will be moist in appearance, often have blisters with reddened bases.
Ouch.
And will be very, very painful. The area will have a tendency to weep a clear or whitish fluid. We call that exudate. And second-degree burns will also cause swelling, so it's important to remove rings and bracelets, things like that.
Yep.
To treat second-degree burns, you want to remove the victim from the heat source immediately and run cool water, not cold, not ice, over the injury for 10 to 15 minutes. Ice traumatizes already damaged skin. After washing and running water over the wound, pat the area dry. Don't rub it because remember that skin is damaged.
Ouch.
The next step would be to apply moist skin dressing such as Xeroform. Spenco Second Skin is another option, or you can make your own non-stick dressings, Telfa pads. with thin layers of aloe vera or petroleum jelly.
Thin layer.
Ramen, honey, which Amy is going to be talking about. Right. We're going to segue into that in just a minute. Be sure to replace these regularly and review the progress of healing. That's always important. Other actions should include, like I said before, removing jewelry like rings and bracelets to prevent the painful constriction caused by swelling.
Right.
Elevate burned extremities. Apply cool compresses. These work best on the neck, armpit, and groin, although recent military studies indicate that cooling of the hands and feet may also help. Avoid the use of ice or even very cold water, as I mentioned before. Give oral pain relief, such as ibuprofen, Advil. Applying anesthetic creams, such as benzocaine or lidocaine. Avoid the lancing of blisters if possible, unless infected and filled with pus. Some very large blisters will, however, break with the slightest pressure and may benefit from controlled drainage. Avoidance of peeling burned skin.
Yes, which sometimes, please don't do that.
That's right. With a second degree burn, you got a real problem if you try to peel off burned skin, because sometimes it comes off in sheets with a second degree burn. That actually happened to me when I was 8 years old. My family went to the beach all day. By the time we went home, I had blisters all over my back. My parents thought peeling the wet, loose skin would help, so they took a skin edge and pulled off a foot-long strip of skin about 2 inches wide. And that's off an eight-year-old. Don't do that. You want to protect adjacent burned fingers and toes if that's happened with a dry barrier in between. Of course, what's on the skin should be moist, but there should be a dry barrier in between the actual digits. That's something that's important. You want, of course, encourage hydration. That's very, very important. And you might consider using a tenting method to keep sheets above extensive burns in people who have second degree burns. I think that that would work.
There is an idea. If you have garden covers, sometimes they have those half circles and you can put the sheets over them. If you put two or three of those over the bed and secure them to the sides, you can put the person's sheet over that. Another thing you can do is if you have wire coat hangers, is you can unfold those and you can also make those like a little arch. And the whole point is you want to cover the person because you don't want a cool draft, you know, making them shiver and get really cold. But anything that touches large areas of these burns that may have lost some skin is very painful. So anything you can think of that can do a little arch over where the patient is sleeping to keep the sheets covering them but not touching them is very helpful.
I absolutely agree. That's a great idea. Now, it's important to avoid the use of lard, oils, or butter on burns, although I've heard people say that lavender oil is good for burns. Honestly, I've researched a little bit. I really am not finding a lot of hard scientific evidence for that particular issue. Remember that many essential oils are not oil, like coconut oil or lard or things like that. They actually are much more aqueous than a typical oil, like olive oil or coconut oil. The thing is with oils is they tend to keep in heat and they could worsen the injury.
Right, that makes sense.
Also, egg whites and toothpaste, long considered to be home remedies, may increase the risk of infection. It's better to use sterile saline solutions to keep the burn area and the nonstick dressings moist, especially if the burns are severe. Now, I love honey. I always have. And I'll tell you, you are going to talk about honey and tell us about its uses, maybe in more things than burns.
I am.
All right. Sounds great.
And so we'd just like to share some of this information with you. If a disaster occurs, of course, we're probably going to run out of pharmaceutical medicines. We've discussed that before. And that's why we want you to store things like antibiotics and over-the-counter medicine. But those things are going to expire eventually. Thankfully, they last a lot longer than the date on the package. We've talked about that. But this raw honey actually never, ever expires. And that is something that is incredible. So if you're going to run out of antibiotics, which we won't be able to reproduce, we might be able to use honey. And it actually has a long history. They've discovered honey has been used for thousands of years. They've discovered it in the Egyptian mummies. They've discovered jars of it that actually are fine. And it's incredible. The use of honey is actually called apitherapy, and it's apitherapy, and includes the use of both honey venom, regular honey, pollen, and something called royal jelly. And these have been used to heal wounds, help sore throats, soothe and calm coughs, provide energy. Of course, we all know if you've got low blood sugar that honey is going to help you provide energy. And of course, to sweeten our drinks and food like tea. Honey is produced, I'm not sure everyone knows this, in the bee's gut. It's then regurgitated. I know that sounds gross.
Bee vomit.
Bee vomit. Into wax cells in the hive. And they use this honey later on in the season when there are no more flowers and pollen to gather for energy and to survive through the winter. So guess what honey bees are? They're preppers.
Yep.
They prepare for the winter. Now, the gut production of the honey is part of the reason for the healing and antimicrobial properties, because what's in the bee's gut gets into the honey. Raw honey for wounds not only destroys bacterial infections, it creates a moist healing environment. And I think if we talk about actual wounds, that you have a destruction of our layer, our protection of skin. You have so many things that are exposed, capillaries, fat, muscle. Those require a nice, moist, healing environment. And what honey provides is that nice, moist environment for healing. It helps to prevent raised scarring. It also prevents and kills bacterial infections. But how does that work? Because honey has a very low pH, I think it's about 2.5, or I believe it's 3.5 actually, which is really low. Honey also produces a hydrogen peroxide-like substance, fluid, that creates an osmotic effect. What's the osmotic effect? It actually draws fluid from the bacteria, and that's how it kills it. So the acid helps prevent the bacteria from growing, and also it sucks the water out of the bacteria, so that helps kill it too. So it not only prevents infections, but it can help destroy infections. Now, several studies have shown honey heals wounds better and faster, with a dramatic increase in decreased infection rates, especially in burn injuries, which is what we were just talking about. So in addition to maybe using the aloe and other things that you were mentioning, raw honey would be one of our choices for burns, and we've used it ourselves.
That's right.
On burns. And the easy way to do it is just put it underneath one of those non-adhesive gauze bandages.
Right. Telfa pads.
Telfa pads, non-adherent, non-stick, and put it over. Now, they've also done research, and they have shown that although we have antibiotic-resistant infections out there, that raw honey is effective against MRSA and strep infections. So it's something that if you have an infection and it's just not really responding, if a doctor's treating you, you might suggest he look up raw honey to treat this, or, you know, add it to your regimen. You can apply it to cuts, scrapes, burns of any depth, especially if medical help's not on the way. We do talk about how you use it for second and third degree burns. Second degree would be generally just, you know, putting it on the gauze. If it's a third degree, which anytime you get a third degree, you need to seek medical help, you can put raw honey on the third degree wound, cover it with plastic wrap. Don't wash it off. We're not trying to get rid of this, because that's going to have so much exudate and fluids coming out of it, because leaking capillaries and leaking blood vessels, you're going to have a lot of fluid. It's going to be flushing out naturally. You need to just keep filling it up with raw honey. So during the treatment, go ahead.
I just want to say that if you are going to apply plastic wrap on an area like that, that may wind up becoming swollen, don't put it all the way around, because that can constrict
Good
the area,
point.
Cause excessive pressure. So you,
right.
you may put some plastic wrap on top of it, but don't wrap it around like you would,
a roll gauze, exactly. So what you're trying to do is just cover the area just a little bit on the outside of where you're protecting, but again, not around an extremity or even around an abdomen or a chest. So you just want to cover that area. But you would do this literally for at least 3 weeks. You are not putting anything else in there. You're not flushing it out with irrigation. You're just going to keep adding more and more raw honey. And you may have to add it pretty frequently. But, you know, if you're in a desperate situation and that's all you've got, You know, it may be what saves someone's life. It just is what it is. You can also cover the outside of the plastic with some clean linen or cotton wrap. Again, don't wrap too tightly around any part of the body because you are going to have a lot of swelling. It's also known to have a calming effect on the mind and promote sleep. A lot of people have sleep issues, especially if we are in a grid down situation. There's a lot of anxiety.
Right.
Honey can help decrease your anxiety and help you get a little bit of sleep. It may also help stabilize wild swings of blood sugar. Because of the way raw honey is metabolized, you don't get an immediate spike in your blood sugar when you take it, and then an immediate decrease like you do with regular sugar. So you do get an increase. So if somebody's having low blood sugar, it does give you that sugar, but it doesn't go so high and then plunge so low. So it kind of evens people out. It is a little bit better for diabetes. For a sore throat, there's a few things you can do. You can use a mild tea. Don't add the honey to boiling water. It does destroy some of those enzymes and the good properties of honey. You want to add it after the tea has cooled down a little bit. You may want to make the tea, put it in the cup, add a little bit of cooled off water to bring the temperature down a little bit, and then add your honey. Honey's not going to melt in cold water, so it does need to still be warm. But again, you don't want to put it in boiling water. It's helpful in the treatment and prevention of oral infections and diseases. You can make a mouthwash out of it that doesn't hurt anything. And again, we talk about it not spoiling or going bad, but it may crystallize. And if you look at this, you can see the crystals around here. There is nothing wrong with this honey. What you can do is just take this jar or whatever container you have, put it in a bowl of, again, warm to hot water, not boiling, but I want to go a little in the warm, but not too hot. Put this in, let it sit for a while. As it warms up, these crystals will actually begin to melt, and it's going to be that soft, gooey honey that you had before without the crystals. Please buy local honey. We have a real bee problem in this country, probably across the world. We need to support our local beekeepers. They may have lost hives. It costs a lot of money and a lot of time. We need to help protect them. We need to help support them. Another reason that's good for buying local bee honey, besides helping your bee farmer, is that if you have allergies, the bees are collecting pollen from many different flowers and trees. You might actually be allergic to some of or a lot of those flowers and trees around you. And your local bee honey is actually like a little bit of a shot. If you just take a little bit of it, you can desensitize yourself possibly to the pollen that causes your sneezing and your hay fever and your swollen face and itchy eyes.
Like an allergy shot.
Exactly. Just like a little bit of an allergy shot. So eat the honey that's produced in your area and you are going to be healthier and save money.
Sounds great. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
A lot of good information there.
Thanks.
You know, that's all the time we have for this week's episode of the Survival Medicine Podcast. I'm Joe Alton.
And I'm Amy Alton.
And we hope to see you next time.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Doom and Bloom Hour with medical preparedness experts Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. Check out our website at www.doomandbloom.net for hundreds of informative articles about survival medicine, gardening, natural remedies, medical supplies, and lots of other good stuff. Contact us, send your email to drbonespodcast@aol.com or use the contact form on the main page of the website. See you next week.